Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Brian's off today. Sometimes our country feels so divided that it's tempting to think that this it's them versus us feeling you probably have is actually something new, but it's not. 150 years ago, we were in worse shape. In 1858, before he was president or even a national figure, Abraham Lincoln addressed the issue that was tearing America apart at the time. As he accepted the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate, he said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free." Well, after the Civil War, the country was no longer split between slave and free states, but that division didn't disappear with the end of the war. And according to our next guest, that division never went away. It's still threatening you and our union. Ibrahim X. Kendi is director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. He is also a columnist at The Atlantic and author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. On The Atlantic, Professor Kendi describes the government of 2018 as a house divided by racism. He argues if the division is allowed to remain, it could lead to the destruction of the American idea. Professor Kendi, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So this idea of anti-racism that you're coining, explain that so that we can frame our debate.
Sure. You know, that was really the point of the piece, to make a case that our nation now is divided between racism and anti-racism. And if we understand racist ideas as ideas that suggest that the racial groups are unequal, then anti-racist ideas suggest that the racial groups are equal. If we understand racist policies as policies that yield racial inequities, then anti-racist policies yield racial equity. And so the combination of racist policies and ideas is racism, and the combination of anti-racist policies and ideas is our anti-racism. And so we have this government and even a body of people, some of whom are promoting racism and some of whom are promoting anti-racism.
So to be clear, we have racism and anti-racism. Is the absence of racism anti-racism, or is that something different? You have to be actively involved in the pursuit to end racism to be an anti-racist?
Yes, because if you do nothing, then the racial inequities that are all around us, then the racist policies that are breeding those inequities will remain, will stay, will grow. And the people who are striving against those inequities and the policies that created them are truly the ones who are anti-racist. And I should also say that those who benefit from those racist policies want us to remain on the sidelines. That's the purpose of racial violence. That's the purpose of racist ideas, to make us think that the problem is not policies, but people.
So it's not enough to say that you are not racist. You are advocating for something called anti-racism. You write about Lincoln's speech describing the government as a house divided, half slave, half free. How does today's division between racism and anti-racism compare to that division in 1858?
Well, clearly, I think in 1858, that division was in many ways regional. The current division, the racial division, is certainly not regional. I mean, there are people in the South and North who are racist and anti-racist. I think in 1858, that division was leading to a conflict that of course became known as the Civil War. That was the most violent American conflict in history. More Americans died as a result of the Civil War than every other military campaign combined. It doesn't appear that the current divisions are headed toward that level of violence, but of course we do see violence, and we see people who are driven to that violence by racist ideas.
In his speech, Lincoln said that our house, and we're talking about our symbolic American house, was not at risk of falling, but of becoming all one thing or all the other. Now, you write that only an embrace of anti-racism can save our union. We're talking about a modern union. If that doesn't come to pass, Do we risk all becoming racist, Professor Kendi?
I think so. And I think that's what Lincoln feared. I mean, think about it. If these slavery and anti-slavery were diametrically opposed, in the same way racism and anti-racism are diametrically opposed. And when you have two constructs that are diametrically opposed, there's no way to create a compromise. There's no way to keep this sort of divided house banded together. I mean, you have it. It is either going to result from an historical standpoint into all one or all the other. And that's why Lincoln made that case in 1858. And I would echo that case today.
If you're listening, you should join this conversation. Call us at 212-433-WNYC or 212-433-9692. Professor Ibram X. Kendi says, we're faced with two options: a government committed to anti-racist policy, or one that is, quote, all racist and wholly illegitimate. What do you think? If nothing has changed, are we destined for an all-racist government? Are we already there? And how does today's division compare to other points in our history? Is racism at its core the poisoned soil, as Professor Kendi says, from which most of today's issues have grown? Call us now to speak to Professor Ibram X. Kendi. He's the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. And that number, again, is 212-433-WNYC. So, Professor Kendi, you're right. For Lincoln to have ignored that divide would have been more radical than addressing it. So the fact that he actually said something, what do you mean by it was more radical?
Well, I think it is easy, I think, today for us to imagine a compromise between racism and anti-racism, to not recognize that fundamental division. I think it is much, much harder for us to recognize that division is an existential threat to the American project, for us to recognize that at least the racist side is potentially headed towards fruition. And I think, so it's easy for us to ignore, to stand back. And I think it's a more radical approach to recognize it, to be decisive in seeking to change it. And I think that's what Lincoln did when he recognized that fundamental division and that the American house was divided.
Professor Kendi, we have a caller from Brooklyn, Chris, who has a question for you. Chris, you're on the line.
May I be heard?
Yes.
Well, Professor Kendi, greetings. Thank you for being on the line with us today. I'd like to ask a couple of questions, but first off, Derrick Bell has something similar where he believed in the critical race theory. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work.
Yes, I'm familiar with his work.
Yeah, basically stating that racism is not something that is trending away or going away, that it's just going to be refined consistently under the system of racism, white supremacy. Do you agree with that also? Is that some of what your book is stating? And also, what do you think are some solutions for us as non-white people in dealing with these situations in whole, you know, as a country and globally, actually, because it's a global system when you really boil down to it?
Thank you so much, Chris. So, Professor Kendi, what do you think are some solutions?
Well, I think in terms of solutions, I think for us to first take, I think, the radical step and define a policy that yields racial inequity as a racist policy. And the reason why I say that's a huge step is because we typically define policies now by their intent, by their stated intent. And so if there's no one intended to cause a bunch of people to their votes to be suppressed or cause all sorts of people to be unemployed, black people, then it must not be racist.
So you're talking about the "I didn't mean it" defense. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, but what if we measured racism by its outcome as opposed to its intent? Then we can then look out at many different political, economic policies, institutional policies, and regard them as racist and change them. And change them with policies that will actually lead to equity between the races.
We have another caller from Huntington. We have Peter on the line. So, Peter, you've been listening to this conversation. What's your view?
So I guess I have a question for the professor that goes and puts together sort of racism and discrimination. What I'm wondering is there a boomerang or a whiplash effect, if you will, by handling the question of racism and discrimination by then being anti-discriminatory, let's say, with quotas and forcing diversity? Isn't that now just propagating the same problem, but the pendulum has swung to the other side? We're trying to get everybody equal, yet at the same time, we're disenfranchising one group because of maybe past history. Isn't there a way to level the playing field without having to swing and be anti-discriminatory to another race?
Thank you so much, Peter. Professor Kendi, what's your response?
Sure. So what I think one of the more critical quotes in American history that actually quoted in the piece was by Justice Harry Blackmun, who dissented from the Bakke case in 1978. And in his dissent, he stated that in order to get beyond racism, we must first take account of race. There is no other way. In order to treat some persons equally, we must treat them differently. We dare not let the Equal Protection Clause perpetuate racial supremacy. And so essentially what he's saying is when you have past or even present policies create inequity, the only way to create equity is through inequity. And so in order to create present equity, you have to be willing to basically keep people at the door to equalize that room. But of course, you have people who refuse to recognize the current inequity that exists, and they imagine that everything's equal and all you're doing is keeping us out of the room for no reason.
Some people hear what you're saying and they're a little frightened by it. So you say the way to get to a more equal society is to actually treat people unequally so that every part that hadn't risen as much could actually rise. Do I understand that correct?
No, I think what I'm ultimately saying is when you have an inequity, how do you create inequity? How do you create equity? And so some would argue, well, let's just eliminate the policies, the past policies that were creating that inequity. But you also have to eliminate the present policies, and you also have to redistribute. So, and what I'm ultimately saying is that it's hard to create equity without figuring out ways to repair the past. And there's no, and some people are willing to, or some people are simply not willing to figure out where's to repair the damage from the past. How do we repair the damage from the past? And I think that's ultimately what I'm talking about.
So you're focusing on repairing the damage to the past. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Duarte Giraldino. Brian is off for the day. If you are just joining us and you want to call in, please feel free to do that. We're speaking with Ebrahim X. Kendi. He's the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. He's also a columnist at The Atlantic and author of Stamped From the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Now we have Linda on the line from Princeton, New Jersey. Linda, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Geraldo and Professor. Professor, I just finished reading Beverly D'Angelo's two books, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and her other book, What It Means to Be White. Now, I'm what you would call a progressive, democratic socialist, and I certainly found room for vast improvement in myself. However, we still have the issue of skin color in this country, which complicates things beyond any belief, because there is a target, an immediate target. The moment a black person comes into view of a white person, there's an immediate visceral response. I don't mean a violent response necessarily, but a strong sense within the person that the other person is different. So there's something wrong in the entire personality of this country that we still have this reaction.
Do you have it yourself?
It's been inculcated for centuries at this point. It's in our DNA. But those books, I think, a public reading, especially of white fragility, to the nation on some given day, publicly, on C-SPAN, anywhere, I think might open a lot of people's eyes, even just a little bit, which would be helpful. We seem to lack imagination as a country.
But do you feel that way? Do you feel that way?
People's shoes and skins. And why that is, I don't know. I don't think it's just white supremacy. I think white supremacy has given us the gift of struggling for this rugged individualism. And part of why racism persists, I think, is that we have not learned to cooperate with one another in this country. Instead of thinking of our own lives and our individualism, we need to function as a group and cooperatively.
Thank you so much, Professor Kendi. How do you respond to that?
Well, I agree that I think we need to figure out a common cause. And I'm happy you mentioned Robin's book, White Fragility, because she makes the argument that I think one of the things that's preventing white people in particular from establishing a sort of common cause with other people is because some white people are not open to critique. They're not open to critique that their ideas are racist. And as soon as their ideas are called racist, they shut down. When in fact, it's very difficult for racist ideas to rain on your head for decades in this country and to never get wet. And so I think it's important for us to be open-minded, to self-critique. Those who consider themselves anti-racist are constantly self-critiquing, constantly confessing racist ideas.
Professor Kendi, I just want to make sure I understand the metaphor you're using, saying that you can have racist ideas rain on your head for years and not get wet. What would get wet mean?
Consuming those ideas, right? I mean, if you're constantly bombarded with the idea that, let's say, black neighborhoods are dangerous, that black people are to be feared, that the reason why that black people are more violent, it's hard for you to not believe that. And then not only to not believe that, to become fearful when black people you don't know emerge into your presence.
I see. By the way, you know, I imagine you're aware of the announcement earlier this month that former White House Chief of Staff, Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, would be heading to the New Yorker Festival. Then, when word got out about this, he was disinvited. Now, that decision was controversial. In a recent article, you criticized the notion that neutrality between racism and anti-racism is possible, that they can cohabitate peacefully. Do you believe that the New Yorker's decision reflects an understanding of your point?
Well, I think it's probably a different sort of a different construct. I think certainly there was this perspective of, you know, let's bring this person here and really question him and critique him, you know, his ideas, and let's ensure that is occurring in this very public sort of place, while others did not feel that his bigotry should even be given a platform. I think as it relates to neutrality, I think we've tried to imagine that there is this place between slavery and anti-slavery, that there is this place between racism and anti-racism. And simply put, those places don't exist. There's no such thing as racial neutrality. There's no such thing as a race-neutral policy. Every policy either yields racial equity or racial inequity.
But wouldn't it? I mean, there are some people who will argue that it's worthwhile listening to, you know, the White House former chief strategist Steve Bannon so that you can understand his view, so that you can be better prepared to attack it if that is your position. But to block him out, to silence him completely, that some people take issue with.
Well, I should say personally, you know, I actually can understand both positions, and I would say personally, I'm actually open to very structured debates. And I think certainly we've, as a nation, gotten away from debates. And if there's ever a time in which we we need to be engaged in debates than it's now. But I wouldn't just say people of different size talking through each other. I mean, I think real structured debates, is something that I think we need.
We have a call from Clarksville, Tennessee, who's been listening to this conversation and wants to ask you a question, Professor Hendy. John, welcome to WNYC.
Hi. I wanted the guest to speak to the connection between racism and capitalism and how, there's a great clip on YouTube with Richard Pryor in an interview where he kind of identifies capitalism as a way to divide people. Divide workers, keep them disorganized, and which enables the capitalists to kind of keep the inequities in place that plague the lives of so many. And I'd like to know the speaker's opinion about to what extent does a person need to be anti-capitalist if they want to be anti-racist?
Thank you so much, John. So, Professor Kendi, the link between racism and capitalism, and can you be anti-racist and support capitalism?
Well, I mean, I think every question that I'm asked, I try to understand it and answer it from an historical perspective. And in Stand from the Beginning, I actually started the history of racism alongside when the history of capitalism began. And so in the long 15th century, you have Portugal and Spain really sort of branching out to really establish the modern world and even the modern world of capitalism. They were simultaneously those who originated the slave trading of African people and the policies that governed it and the racist ideas that substantiated it. And so really from the beginning, racism and capitalism have been intertwined. And those who are truly interested in creating an equitable world for the races should probably also be interested in creating an equitable world for the classes.
Professor Kendi, we're almost out of time, but you spend a lot of time thinking about these issues. Are you hopeful that we can get to a place where racism will be at least minimized, or do you not see a solution going forward?
Well, I am hopeful, primarily because I think from a philosophical perspective, you have to be hopeful to be a change agent. I mean, because, think about it. If you don't believe change is possible, how can you really do all of the hard things that it takes to bring about change? And so I'm hopeful from a philosophical perspective. But on the other hand, certainly, as a student of racism and knowing how pervasive these policies are, knowing how pervasive racist ideas are, of course, it's going to take a tremendous amount of change in order to eliminate racism. And I'm not quite sure that people are truly willing to make that change, partly because I think many people have been convinced that racism is in their self-interest when it's really not.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
And you've been listening to Ebrahim X. Kendi. He's director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. He's also a columnist at The Atlantic and author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Thank you.